Welcome to Building a Powerful Left in the United States. I'm your MC, Alan Minsky. On today's show, we're going to branch out away from the mainstream of the progressive left. First off, we'll be doing that in an aesthetic manner, as we'll hear from comic Jimmy Dore. Whatever one makes of the recent massive rally to restore sanity brought to you by Jon Stewart and comrade Stephen Colbert, which after all was criticized by rival Bill Maher as the million meh march, since it seemed, ultimately, so noncommittal. It certainly showed that in recent times, political comedy has moved front and center into American political discourse. I don't think you'll mistake Mr. Dore's contribution to the series as noncommittal, and he is representative of a powerful left progressive community of comics across the country. Following Jimmy Dore, we'll hear from Mark Ames of ExiledOnline.com and the author of the book Going Postal. I see Mark Ames, in many respects, as picking up the mantle of Hunter S. Thompson. It's my sense, and I think the sense of many, that the left often is seen in the United States as not having much of a backbone. Well, this is not true of Mr. Ames. And we'll hear his ideas on how he believes the left should speak, along with what he thinks they should be saying. Then following Mark Ames, we'll hear from two revolutionaries. In the weeks leading up to this series, talking to people about it, I was surprised how often people simply said, we need a revolution. Considered off the charts in mainstream American political discourse, the idea, however, is not forgotten by people in the general society. So we'll hear from Sansara Taylor and then Brian Becker, two people committed to bringing socialist revolution to the United States. And as you'll see, their vision of a post-revolutionary society certainly matches up with the wishes of many who would see themselves as more conventional, non-revolutionary progressives. Following that, we'll hear from Vijay Prashad, a radical critic of U.S. foreign policy. We'll hear his perspective on how he thinks a powerful left can be built and what it would mean to peoples around the world. And then we'll hear from Jay Waljasper about the notion of the commons and how he feels that the commons must be one of the central organizing principles of a revitalized left. All that on building a powerful left in the United States. Take it away, Jimmy Dore.
Hi, this is Jimmy Dore from KPFK Los Angeles, and I was asked by Alan Minsky for ideas on how we can make the left grow stronger in America, and I have two proposals. One, we have to make our own opportunity to show the rest of the country that our ideas are actually better than other people's ideas. How do we do that? Well, I think a solid, concrete example of our progressive ideas actually being put to work here in the form of government and public policy, and then seeing it come to fruition, and then we have results. Well, how do we get that? Well, I propose we tell the South we want to fight the Civil War again. Hear me out. When the time comes to fight, we don't show up. We just give. We go, we give, you guys win, you get to have your own country. Huh? And then they get to have their own country with their own ideas, and we get to have our own country with our own ideas, and then we get to compare and contrast afterwards, and you get to see which country you'd like to live in. For instance, one country would have healthcare, social security, high-speed rail, and the other country wouldn't. One country would respect a woman's right to choose and the right of anyone to marry anyone else that they loved. And one country wouldn't. One country would have a government that expects its food and makes sure it's safe to eat and protects the environment. And one country would let corporations rape the earth. One country would have a state religion, higher income inequality, rampant pollution, toxic dumping, toll roads, and free guns. And one country wouldn't. One country would have a strong social safety net for workers and their families to help mitigate the pain of economic downturns. And one country would put you in jail if you lost your job or your house. One country would fund public education and fill its books with accurate facts and science. And one country would defund public education and fill its books with myths and fables and creationism. Now, which country would you want to live in? Can we do this? I think this is doable. I think it would really help, too, because I'm tired of fighting the ignorant to make our country better. Let's just give them their own country and check back in 10 years. Does that sound like a doable thing? I have my second proposal. Here's my second proposal. Is that we need to get more voters voting progressively. How do we do that? Well, we have to strengthen our numbers, and core progressive voters have been systematically disenfranchised by the criminal justice system. which is not colorblind, by the way. Once you're deemed a felon, you can no longer vote. Yes, I say we have to let felons vote again because that has been our way to systematically disenfranchise minorities in America. If you look at our criminal justice system, it is not doled out equally. Minorities are way overrepresented inside of prisons in America, right? So someone said, when I proposed this once before, somebody said to me, really? Do you think you have the same morality as a felon? And I was like, well, I guess I have to ask you just which felons are you talking about? Is my morality different than the felons on Wall Street that knowingly ruined our economy for personal gain? Or how about the felons at Halliburton and Blackwater? Or how about the morality of the felons who ordered torture? How about the morality of the felons who carried out torture? Does Lloyd Blankenfein have more morality than Martha Stewart? Or how about the morality of the felons who used steroids and then played professional baseball? How about the morality of the felons who then lied about it to Congress? See, I think what they mean is that my morality is different than the felons that we actually choose to prosecute, as opposed to the felons we admire and pat on the back. As usual, morality is what the people in power say it is. And those are my two ideas. We let the South secede, and we let felons vote. And the left will be back on top. And I'm Jimmy Dore.
This is Alan Minsky. The show is Building a Powerful Left in the United States, and I'm joined now by Mark Ames. Mark Ames oversees and writes for the website Exiled Online, and he is the author of Going Postal. Mark Ames, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me on, Alan.
Well, the reason I asked you on, Mark, is because when I read your writing, I really sense that you capture a lot of what a lot of Americans feel, which is just a lot of outrage towards the system and its imbalances, and you advocate for sane, progressive public policies when you get around to advocating public policy. And I really feel that you capture an outrage that is so rarely captured by the other voices on the American left. So your thoughts on the sort of impotence of so much of the argument from the left?
Yeah, but the left has even lost its memory of when it used to be aggressive and used to fight. I mean, you talk to people now, except I guess older people. I can barely remember because I was a little kid at the end of the hippie days. But you talk to older people, they, of course, remember. Do people have this idea that the left is and always has been just wimpy, I mean, for lack of a better word. And this is a pretty mean country that respects viciousness. And all you have to do is look at Fox News, who destroys the competition in terms of viewership. And there's no reason I can see, there's no logical reason why. I mean, this isn't sort of a grade school civics debate. This is a fight over power and wealth, and these fights have never historically been, you know, tame fights or fights that are all about following rules and civility and so on. This is the fight over existence, and there's only one side in that fight, and that is the right and the right wing and the rich and everybody who's just mean and has bad plans and who have brought this country to the disastrous state that it's in. And the other side just keeps thinking if we're good and our arguments are sound, that will somehow prevail. And I don't know what it will take. I mean, this has been going on for more than three decades now, this naive belief. So what I've been writing about for some years now, and part of this, I think, came from looking at America from afar when I lived out in Russia and also watching Russian politics, where after the collapse of communism, they had to kind of rebuild everything again, is that if you're serious about fighting in politics, you have to take the fight a lot more seriously. And it's not about being able to pat yourself on the head about how good you are. It's about fighting over wealth, over power, and over trying to make a better place, a better country. And it's not going to be given up easily. It's not going to be handed over. And I think that lesson is clear. We're not taught much about what happened in the 30s, but it was pretty vicious, and a lot of people died before this country became a bit less mean and policies were put in place that allowed for a nice, comfortable middle-class existence.
Yeah, actually, there's a few things that come to mind. You know, if you look at something like Rage Against the Machine and Zach De La Rocha, you know, connected with all sorts of youth in terms of an extremely radical message, nobody would listen to that and think that this guy wasn't there to fight for them. And again, that just is going to attract a significant portion of people because they're just not going to sign on to something which isn't going to be adamant about the position that it holds. And I think a case in point is the financial collapse and the venom that has been expressed towards bankers, as it were, towards the financial industries. And most of that public expression of venom that has been attractive to people has come from the Tea Party right.
I think some polls showed that people who blamed Wall Street for economic problems and the financial collapse were like 10 points more likely to vote Republican than Democrat. And it's not as, you know, irrational as it might seem, because it's not like the Democrats stand for anything. But look, there's a lot of anger and spite and malice right now, and people have all kinds of reasons to be pissed off, and there's only one side that acknowledges that and that's harnessing it, and it's harnessing it for all the wrong ends. I mean, what the right and the billionaires and so on are doing is focusing all that rage and spite against public sector workers now. People are pissed, and they're not going to show much, you know, what these AIG, for example, when these AIG guys, you know, were given bonuses after destroying everything. This is early in Obama's administration. They were going to take these huge multimillion-dollar bonuses anyway, and that seemed to scare the establishment. It scared the Democrats, this thought of class war. So they just kind of backed out of that class war, and the Republicans moved in and are turning private sector middle class against the public sector middle class. And it's like the slumlord turning one part of the ghetto against the other part of the ghetto. It's really messed up. And it's just going to stay this way because that anger and malice is there. It's building. This is, anyway, a historically meaner country than a lot of countries. And I just, first of all, this has to be acknowledged, I think, on the left for tactical and strategic reasons. And secondly, what you said, I completely agree with. I mean, there's also only one side in this fight that seems to have convictions that they really stand behind no matter what and stand beside each other, and that is the right, even though their entire ideology has been completely exposed for a total failure, and it's screwed everything up, and it's ruined, you know, a country that was doing pretty well, completely ruined, and ruined half the world. Nevertheless, they still believe in it, and they're standing by it. And I think the left needs to spend time figuring out really what it stands for in ideologically, because you can't really rely on Marxism or the New Deal. You know, it's a different world. I don't think the left has really given much thought to anything except not being the right since the mid-late 70s. I can't say that I know or other people know a real clearly defined ideology on the left.
Well, I do know that the left, as it were, is supposed to represent prosperity for all people, not just for the extremely wealthy. It is definitely supposed to fight for the political rights, the liberties, and the economic welfare for the vast majority of people. I don't think it's difficult to devise policy proposals, but it certainly does need to have a clarity about those policy proposals. But even issue by issue, when it gets the idea that it wants to present, I agree. It's put forward very weakly. And I think you really hit the nail on the head about a lot of resentment in the society. And I think that there's a sense that the people who are advocating on the left are not speaking the language of the very people who they claim to represent. And I really love your thesis about spite in society and the way that spite plays and the way the left loses the opportunity to have that energy inform them when the spite really is directed against the people who are at the very upper crust of society devising public policies that hurt the very people who then feel the spite.
Unfortunately, and I don't mean to sound like, you know, an old lefty on this or whatever, but the left has a very sort of middle class sentimental attitude towards politics, I think, which is we don't need to, like, to dirty ourselves up in this fight. Like, that's the other side. You know, people have to remember that the right, which was in sort of political wilderness for about 30 or 40 years while the country was kind of dominated by a more liberal left of center landscape, and the right always complained about this, and they would never go to protests, and they would never shout people down the way the left would do in the universities. They were known as the and until they got all energized and funded and radicalized in the 70s and late 70s. And the left just sort of stepped out of that fight and hasn't been back there since. And I think part of that is this lack of a clearly defined, I mean, are people on the left willing to, I mean, can they see this a future, or are they talking about just tinkering with policy changes? I mean, are they talking about like a larger political vision? Are they talking about tinkering with policy in order to make things better? I think the left has become very technocratic. You know, Obama is a perfect example of that. And then they focus on sort of identity issues and kind of celebrity. I mean, just one example, there's an enormous amount of progressive energy enormous amount focused on the 180 or so inmates in Guantanamo, which is an outrage and it's a violation of international law and human rights and so on. But there is nothing, I don't hear anything, hardly ever, except from a few lonely voices, about what hundreds of thousands of Americans, American citizens, go through locked up in our absolutely savage prison system, which is pretty much unlike, it's definitely unlike any prison system in, you know, in the first world. And we have, you know, more people incarcerated per capita than any country on earth. We have all kinds of human rights violations going on all the time. Half of these places are rape camps. Nobody says anything about it because it's kind of not, I don't know, it gets into something structural, and it gets into structural problems in this country. And I think that sort of thing scares a lot of the left, which likes to fight easier fights, which are very much more narrowly focused, and they can very easily come across as definitely good. It's actually, I find it infantile and infuriating. And again, in the 60s and 70s, the prisoners' rights movement was huge. George Jackson was, you know, Soledad Brother, and these guys were sort of heroes. There were prison uprisings, and it made people think about what went on inside and outside, and, you know, how society was ordered and structured and wealth inequality and everything. But all we kind of focus on, and again, it should be, but it just shouldn't be so disproportionately this way, focusing just on 180 foreign inmates in Guantanamo, as if that was shut down and we won a victory on that finally, as if that would change everything. It's not going to change anything. It's just going to make a few people, rich progressives, whatever, feel better about themselves. But it's not going to do anything about all the massive levels of human rights violations going on in our prison system in this country.
At the end of your excellent article on spite in America and how it motivates people towards the political right, that somehow the feelings of just being beaten down in the society that people have, you know, is turned against what are perceived to be the liberal elites and not the sort of Republican Chamber of Commerce class of people who are consistently advocating policies that just exacerbate people's exploitation across the society. But at the end of the article, you suggest that, you know, given the current crisis, this is a real opportunity, given the clear villains of the generation of the current economic crisis from Wall Street, the exploitation of people in terms of the whole financial crisis and the corruption of the political class, that a vibrant left could capture this spite at this moment, that there's an opening there. So just final thoughts on that possibility.
Well, yeah, this is a bit more, this was kind of more tactical. I was definitely, in the first draft, the first version of that article some years ago, I was thinking much more tactically, like, what we need to do in order to win is just so damn obvious. It is to actually get the class war. It is to fight back in the class war. I mean, again, remember, Warren Buffett himself famously said, there is a class war going on, but there's only one side, the rich, my side, that's fighting it, and it's winning. And that says it all. And the leaders of the left, what's called the left in this country, are terrified of class war, do not want to go there. They just want to be technocratic about everything, which means the class war keeps going on. It's just that we are just getting mowed down all the time. And I think it's somewhat liberating almost to just call out who is doing this to us and call out how kind of wretched our situation is. All the wealth is being concentrated and at an increasing rate in a very, very tiny few hands at the very top. And these people should be hated and should be envied, yes. But they should be hated, they should be targeted, and people need to remind themselves and remind everyone else that these people who have taken their money from our pockets, that they live lives that have nothing to do with our lives. They live lives like Olympian gods. They fly around in their own airplanes and don't have to wait in TSA pat-down lines like the rest of us. Their kids don't even know what a checkout counter, at a supermarket is like. You know, the only thing they ever worry about is remembering who their servants are and what their names are. And the rest of us can't even afford education anymore. I mean, middle-class people can't. People need to get pissed off, and they're right to be pissed off, and they're going to be pissed off. It's just that because only one side is fighting this fight, we're turning all of our anger just against the government or just against public sector workers, you know, who should be our sort of middle and working class comrades, rather than against the people who did this to us. We can do that. It's very easy. Just don't be afraid to say what's on this.
Mark Ames, your website is Exiled Online. You're the author of the book, Going Postal. Thank you so much for joining us on Building a Powerful Left in the United States.
Thanks for having me on.
This is Alan Minsky, and the series is Building a Powerful Left in the United States. I'm joined now by Sansara Taylor. She writes for Revolution Newspaper, is a supporter of the Revolutionary Communist Party, and is on the advisory board of World Can't Wait. Welcome, Sansara Taylor.
Hi, Alan. Thanks for having me.
I want to ask your vision about building a powerful left in the United States, of course, but I want to frame it this way. On the show so far, the term revolution has come up quite a bit. And of course, it's very much in the air right now because of what's happening in Egypt. Can you just broadly first describe what you think a powerful left in the United States would look like, and then clarify your sense of how a revolution may play a role in that?
I'm going to flip the questions that you ask, because I think one sets the context for the other. I think fundamentally, right now, humanity, not just in the U.S., but worldwide, is locked into a system of worldwide exploitation and oppression called imperialism. And it's a system, frankly, U.S. imperialism is what's backed and put in place and held in place Mubarak in Egypt for 30 years. It's the country that's invaded and destroyed Afghanistan and Iraq. It's the country that has rained destruction around the world. And here within this country has, you know, 2 million people in prison. One in four women are raped. People in unemployment and poverty. This is a system that we need to get rid of. Revolution is actually the dismantling and overturning of that system and the replacement with new institutions, a new system, a socialist system, a new state power, a new economy, new social relations among people. And to be real, socialism in any given country needs to be a part of a worldwide struggle to get to a global emancipation, worldwide communism, a world without class divisions, without nations, without men oppressing women, without one people oppressing other people, where everybody has not only the means to a decent life, but to cultural and intellectual life as well. And this is possible, but it actually takes revolution. And I think it's a really important question you're asking, because people do throw the term around all the time. But revolution is not just a big social movement, and it's not just a lot of upheaval, and it's not just a change in attitudes. It's an actual overturning of one system and the forging of a new system. And I think that's what we need to be going for. And in that context, all kinds of people searching for answers, contributing their thinking, organizing against and fighting against crimes of this system needs to play a role. But fundamentally, you need to have the leadership and the vision of where that's going. The Revolutionary Communist Party just published a constitution for the new Socialist Republic of North America, draft proposal for the future republic. And even in the name, it's not the new Socialist Republic of the United States. It's the future, whatever republic is brought into being in what is currently known as the United States, but actually the continent of North America. Even the borders will be forged through that struggle, what territory, who makes it up. But I think that human beings, human throughout the world, need emancipation, need revolution, and we have to start there, and then our work today needs to be geared towards what can hasten to bring about the conditions where that revolution could be made, what needs to be done to prepare people, to organize people, to prepare them to be able to win a struggle like that, and to know what they need to do to put into place the kind of liberatory society where humanity can really flourish.
One of the other central issues of this series, of course, is the fact that radical ideas, revolutionary ideas, or generally defined even just left ideas, have very little traction among the general population, at least in ways that are evident. How would you seek to rectify that?
We're definitely living in a dark time. It's a time where a lot of people don't feel a lot of hope. A lot of people are constricted in their imaginations even to, frankly, only imagining incremental change, if imagining any change at all. But I think it's actually very instructive what's happening in a place like Egypt right now. This is a society that was locked in so-called stability for 30 years, where people's anger was suppressed, where they swallowed it, they choked on it. A lot of it was turned against themselves or each other. This is not that uncommon from a lot of what goes on among the youth in the inner cities in this country, whose anger is legitimate but is suffocated and turned inward a lot of the time. There's a society where people live for decades. And you could look at it and say, wow, they put up with this for decades. They would put up with this forever. Or at best, it would take many years of organizing. No, sometimes things break and they erupt. And people and conditions are changed both through the workings of the system itself, the crisis that it goes into, whether economic or social or international, and through the work of revolutionaries all the way along to open people's eyes, to organize them into the movement for revolution, to have a vision and leadership and organization prepared so that when things do break out, people can go as far as they can to towards making revolution, towards either advancing revolutionary accumulating forces and understanding when it's not an all-out revolutionary situation, or if there's a full-on revolutionary crisis, actually being able to win the struggle for power so that we can put into place a system where people's economic needs are met not through exploiting people across the planet, but through a socialist economy, not through treating the environment as an externality to the economy, something to be plundered and thought about by future generations, but by treating the environment as something that we need to be caretakers of and development and economy in a way that's sustainable. A different world is possible, and what we're doing today needs to be geared towards that. That's what the Revolutionary Communist Party is doing, and we're uniting with anybody who wants to fight for a better world, even if they don't share our full vision, but who wants to struggle towards that. You have to be prepared for that, but then also you have to be working and tense to developments that don't get brought about because of our organizing, but because of actual convulsions of this system. And right now, American capitalism is going through tremendous changes. It's going through tremendous changes internationally, economically, socially, and culturally. And these are the kinds of things we need to be studying and working on. These are the kinds of things we're analyzing every week in Revolution newspapers so that people can learn to understand where the openings are for revolutionary advance. What's going on? Why is it happening? How do people need to get organized? And towards what ends? And then when things do break out in a bigger way, you have the basis to go somewhere. This is one of the big tragedies, actually, is that there's a lot of heralding these days of leaderless movements. Isn't it better if you don't have leaders? No. What happens when you don't have leaders, and you see this a year and a half ago in Iran with the green upsurge, or what was called the green upsurge, people were crying out. After a few days, people come into motion and they start to question in ways that they hadn't for years, and they were demanding to know, who can lead us out of this? And in Egypt, you see the same thing. People are looking for leadership, and the leadership that is there, there's not consolidated leadership, but you have different people vying for either a new way of incorporating Egypt into this sort of framework of imperialist-dominated Middle East, or more reactionary fundamentalist forces. And the idea of actual liberating revolutionary socialist, revolutionary communist forces who could bring about a world where humanity would actually flourish, they're not there for people. There are some, but they need to be stronger. And there's nothing to celebrate about not doing everything you can ahead of those crises to popularize the leadership that you have, to organize people into a movement for revolution, to get connected with that movement. And that's the work that the Revolutionary Communist Party is doing today.
Sansara Taylor is a writer for Revolution Newspaper. She is a supporter of the Revolutionary Communist Party, and she is on the advisory board of World Can't Wait. Thank you for joining us, Sansara Taylor.
Thanks, Alan.
I'm Alan Minsky, and this is Building a Powerful Left in the United States. I'm joined now by Brian Becker, a founder and central organizer for the Party for Socialism and Liberation, PSL, and a national coordinator with the Answer Coalition. Welcome, Brian Becker.
Thank you.
Just right off the bat, the left in the United States, whether radical or progressive, is not a powerful political force in this society right now. There are so many crises across society, and of course, the economic crisis seems in particular to have opened up a space for a strong response from the political left, and yet there's something of a vacuum. Your vision for building a powerful left in the United States?
I don't think there's a simple answer to how to build a powerful left, but I believe that it not only is possible, but I think it's inevitable because, as you mentioned, the crises of capitalism, the crisis of severe, protracted, enduring unemployment and underemployment, the crisis of massive foreclosures, the problem of deepening, intensifying, and expanding poverty. These are systemic problems that flow from capitalism, and there is no alternative other than the reorganization of society and the use and utility of its resources outside of the socialist, economic, and political model. So that while the left has been largely ineffective in many areas in the past decades, I believe that it will rise again, not simply because, or not because at all, people have necessarily read the books of Marx and Engels and Lenin or other socialist leaders, but because the crises of capitalism itself compels people to look for alternatives, makes people look for answers, and most importantly, it makes people resist because they must in order to just live. And I think that's what we're seeing in the coming period.
I want to ask you this, not if Glenn Beck or O'Reilly were talking to you and dismissing you. What do you say when you deal with progressive Democrats who roll their eyes when they hear somebody advocate a kind of revolutionary socialism?
The progressive so-called Democrats are fundamentally apologists for a system that perpetuates all kinds of ridiculous oppression. In other words, the oppression that could be easily remedied, like the problems of homelessness or the problems of unemployment or the problem of endless militarism and the diversion of resources from society's needs to military spending. And people in the progressive democratic circle always make the argument that revolutionary change is utopian, it's a dream, it's just impossible, it's not practical, that they have the practical answers on their side. But let's look at the last 2 years. The argument of the progressive Democrats was that if we elect a progressive or liberal president, say Barack Obama, and if we get sizable majorities in the Senate and the House of Representatives, then and only then can we make practical, specific, and real change possible. Well, that happened. They had the presidency. They had a vast majority in the Senate. They had a huge majority in the House of Representatives. And yet the problems of unemployment, the problems of homelessness, and the problem of war, for instance, didn't diminish. They increased. And so the idea of reforming capitalism is, I think, by virtue of the experience we've gone through, proved to be a utopian, dreamlike concept. And as hard as it may seem to build revolutionary change, I think that's the realistic option. You know, whenever the people are quiet politically, whenever there's the perception of passivity or apathy, people always say revolution is impossible. They probably said that, for instance, in Egypt just a couple months ago. But as soon as the people, in response to the crisis of capitalism, the crisis of repression, the crisis of the denial of their rights, as soon as the people wake up, go into the streets, start fighting, build their own organizations, when the left and progressive organizations become strong again, then people think, oh, of course, that was an inevitable outcome of the crisis. So I think the Democrats who preach reform within the Democratic Party as the method are, in fact, the utopians.
There's real awareness now across the society. Everybody knows the economy is in tatters. There's a crisis going on in the society. Confidence about, quote unquote, the direction of the country is low, has remained very low. When you're out and about in society and you present your ideas, is your sense that there is an appetite for revolution, even if it's not articulated exactly like that?
I think there's a profound desire on the part of tens of millions of people in the United States for a profound radical change. I think the big question that they have is whether change is possible. And the answer to that question is yes, change is possible. And when we present to people and show people that we actually do have the power, if we mobilize, if we organize, if we use the power that people have, especially the power of working people, without whose work, without whose labor society cannot move, if we show that we can, that we have the power and we can utilize the power, people are very receptive to change. They know society does not have to be this way. They know it does not have to be that 500 billionaires have the equivalent wealth of the 3 billion poorest people on the planet. And they know that in a country as rich as the United States, it's inexcusable that 30 million people are either unemployed or underemployed or not counted anymore because they can't find work. So I think there's a great appetite for change. I think the message of socialism, while the word socialism has been demonized because, as I said earlier, anti-communism became the unofficial religion of the United States after World War II, even though that word has been demonized, the content of socialist ideas is fully embraced by most people.
Brian Becker is a founder and central organizer of the Party for Socialism and Liberation and a national coordinator with ANSWER. Thank you so much for joining us on Building a Powerful Left in the United States.
Thank you.
This is Alan Minsky. The series is Building a Powerful Left in the United States. And I'm joined now by Vijay Prashad, who is a professor of international studies at Trinity College, and he is the author of The Darker Nations, A People's History of the Third World. Welcome to the show.
Thank you so much.
And I've asked you to join us because you are a specialist in international studies, and I want to talk with you about what it would mean for the world if a powerful left was formed within the United States. But first, your ideas on what could revitalize a left in the United States and what would be the prevailing ideas that would animate such a left.
It's a very good question. It's a very broad question. And for us, it's a matter of survival. That is, for us, I mean the planet. I mean, the United States is the core country that holds together a set of alliances that are working for ill in the world. But ironically, because it also controls so much of how culture is produced, it pretends and has been able to convince a lot of people that it is a force for good. So, for instance, when trouble breaks out in North Africa, the United States can send an envoy, and the language the envoy speaks is the language of peace, when in fact, when they say words like peace and stability, what they mean is the status quo, which is unequal and dangerous, and not the stability of the future, which is what we seek. So the question that you've asked is a question for the ages. It is a very important question for the survival of the planet. Can it happen? Can a left emerge in the United States which is sufficiently strong to change the direction of U.S. policy? Thus far, history has told us that we have a lot of work to do. Anytime a left has attempted to rise, it has been struck down. I live in Northampton, Massachusetts, which is the home, or at least the place where Daniel Shays attempted to move the American Revolution in a progressive direction. And not far from where I live, Daniel Shays and his comrades were cut down, and the first attempt to put the United States in a leftward direction was reduced in bloodshed. And since then, we have seen many such instances. So one has to be a little realistic about the capabilities for the emergence of the left. When it has tried to rise, it has been very badly struck down. But the left must rise anyway. I mean, the question is, in this country, when the right wants to emerge as a popular movement on the ground, it has no problem. There was anxiety and anger at the Democratic Party winning the election in 2010, coming into office. President Obama in 2008 comes into office. In 2009, when Obama wins the election, there is anger on the right. It spawns small groups of people protesting. That gets picked up and financed by major political players in Washington, D.C., and they create a rightward pole called the Tea Party. So populism has been seized by the right. The left will mobilize tens of thousands on the street, but we are unable to move from those tens and thousands to something like a Tea Party formation on the left, which pressures the body politic in the United States. And I think those of us on the left need to think very seriously, very hard. Why was it that our mass anti-war demonstrations in 2003 and 2004, why were we not able to translate those into an organized political force? Some of it has to do with the fact that we don't have the kind of power from above. The ruling class in America is very stable. There are not many fractures. There's no section of the ruling class which wants to adopt the agenda of the left. Rather, the ruling class section adopted the energy of the left and put that behind Obama. So how do we create a platform which gives those mobilizations integrity and doesn't allow them to be taken up by sections of the ruling class for their interests, such as tens of thousands on the street in New York City against the war, and that energy taken up to elect Obama, rather than that energy taken up to create a left pole which is going to try to influence and move the American body politic. So our task has to be, we have tens of thousands of people capable of going on the street. How does that energy be protected from co-optation by the Democratic Party? And on the other hand, how does that energy get organized into a force capable of creating a left pole? That's the conversation I'm very interested in. I think people need to have that conversation in their localities. It has a lot to do with us breaking our addiction to the Democratic Party. You know, that has to be, I think, the first addiction we need to break. We need to be confident that if we are from outside the Democratic Party constituting our own political platform, that we may be able to pull people away from it to create an authentic left pole. That's one. The other thing is, what should be the demands? you know, there are some remarkably basic demands that we can make, which are humanitarian demands and which are opposed to the kind of war machine policies of both the major parties. Simple demand, I think, we should say in localities, no more funding should go toward things like subvention to small firms, corporations. In my town, we have war companies, companies that produce machinery for war that routinely get tax benefits. So we need to be doing a much stronger job of refusing to allow them to get tax benefits. The tax benefit should go to harness the good side of history, not the bad side. That's one kind of thing. We need to be demanding that monies in our localities go towards helping local initiatives, farming, things like that. Things that are commonsensical in some liberal areas, they have been taken up, but they're not generalized. These are small ways of building confidence among people that we are not just against war, but we are for different economies, we are for different social visions. The challenge, I think, for us to peel people away from the Democratic Party is that we have to say that we are not just naysayers, we are not just opposed to war, but we have a credible, concrete proposal to reconstruct the life world in which we live. And if we are able to do that, if we are able to make ourselves a genuine alternative, if we are able to give people confidence that our mobilization is not simply a mobilization of no, but it's a mobilization of survival, I think there will be a future for the left in this country. But unless we do certain things like that, we'll simply be seen as naysayers, as people who are against something. But we need to be for things, and often the things we are for are the small things that make life better, which when you scale them up are quite transformative. So that is my vision for the reconstruction of the left.
And on the plane of international relations, if there was such a formation, a significant formation, and it could be understood across the world how to communicate with such a left formation in the United States, what would it mean to people who are fighting against regimes such as Mubarak's in Egypt that everyone knows are supported by the United States? If there was such a left formation in the United States, it strikes me that the people in the world who are seeking to better their own societies, to have real democracy in their societies, that they then could look, even if it's a minority movement, but it has some kind of cohesive formation, they can look to that formation and be in dialogue, be supportive of it, and get support back. Your thoughts?
Imagine that in Tahrir Square in Cairo, young people are picking up tear gas canisters, they are pointing at guns, all of these things with the slogan on them, made in the USA. In other words, the contribution currently of the United States to peace, justice, and humanity in North Africa is warfare and warfare-making equipment. If we had a credible left organization in the United States, a left pole, a mass left organization, if we immediately laid a demand forward that the $1.3 billion that goes to the Mubarak regime must be stopped immediately, and at the same time we demand that the mass subvention of Israel's war-making apparatus also be stopped immediately. That would give an incredible sense of confidence in the lands that go from Western Sahara out to the Hindu Kush Mountains, that the United States is not committed to two regimes whose entire policy is war-making. I mean, not war-making with each other, but war-making with everybody else. Right now, in Tahrir Square, the thugs of Mubarak are killing people, and at the same time, the F-16 planes from the Israeli Air Force have bombed Gaza. These two things are happening parallel, both underwritten by the United States of America. So the demand that would come from a left pole today would be end the subsidy to both these regimes that are committed to violence against ordinary people. And that would be a principal demand. And secondly, I think demand that could be made from us to the people in Tunisia, to the people in Egypt, etc., our statement to them is we would like to help them reconstruct their economies so that Egypt is not reliant upon American tourists, but where Egypt and the United States can trade goods in good favor to each other.
Vijay Prashad is a professor of international studies at Trinity College in Connecticut and is the author of The Darker Nations, A People's History of the Third World. Thank you so much for joining us on Building a Powerful Left in the United States.
Thanks a lot.
This is Alan Minsky. The show is Building a Powerful Left in the United States. I'm now joined by Jay Waljasper. He is the author of All That We Share, How to Save the Economy, the Environment, the Internet, Democracy, Our Communities, and Everything Else That Belongs to Us. And Jay, the primary concept that is put forward in your book and in a lot of your other writing is the notion of the commons. In fact, you had a recent article on Common Dreams called The Commons Moment is Now. So please explain, obviously, how to save the economy, the environment, are notions that would be central to a revitalized left. How central you believe the commons movement would be to a revitalized left in the United States?
I'd like to point out that the revival of the right that we've seen over the last 30 years, I think, really began when they kind of began to shift their focus away from being a reactionary group that was against civil rights, against labor unions, and said they were a group that was in favor of the market. And the market was a new word for them instead of, a kind of a code word for capitalism. And that really got a lot of people excited, this notion of the market. It was a fresh new idea. So I think the left, as valuable as the critiques and the accomplishments of the left are, I think there's a need for kind of a new idea on the left as well. A lot of people are not giving, I think, progressives their due. And I think the commons is that kind of fresh concept that can get people excited again and kind of offer just a slightly different framework to take another look at sustainability, equity, and a lot of issues that are promoted by the left. So the commons, in short, means just all the things that belong to all of us. That's a powerful idea. It involves the internet. It involves parks. It involves the environment. It involves, pharmaceutical drugs that have been created with our money. But if you start thinking about all the things that belong to all of us and how shabbily they're being treated under the current political regimes, that is a powerful idea that I think could bring more people into the ranks of the activists and progressives and the left.
Now, on the cover of your book, All That We Share, there's a beautiful picture of what I take to be an urban garden.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So a kind of thing where, like, the relationship of this kind of project to the involvement of people on a day-in, day-out level, that's very central to the notion of the commons that you're talking about.
Yeah, the commons can affect policy, but it also can have a great effect on just the fabric of our lives. The more things that we do together. One of the mottos of the commons that we like to say is we need our society has gotten radically out of joint in the direction of me, me, me. And the commons is a way to bring it back to the we. And that can be community gardens, that can be social policies that are fair for everybody, that can be environmental sustainability. But just kind of an infusion of the we into our culture can really make a huge difference in just how people think about the world.
And so your sense is then if, and again, this series is informed by the notion that, 3 years into this massive economic downturn, with all of the array of social ills and injustices that already were present in American society, the absence of a revitalized and growing left is glaring. In your sense, though, that
this is not Cairo. I mean, people are not out in the streets, and you wonder why.
And in your sense, though, if we look at where humanity is at the beginning of the 21st century, that the commons has to be very central to a notion of a revitalized left in the United States.
I believe so. The commons is a really big idea, and it's not a new idea. In fact, it's been an organizing principle for human societies almost since the beginning, but we've lost sight that there are a lot of, in the market saturated culture that we have, we've lost sight that there are these things that really belong to all of us. And some of them are done through government, and some of them are just done through civic projects and civic engagement as well. But all of them put an emphasis upon what people can do together and puts an emphasis upon that everybody, it's the equality thing, it's the equity thing. Everybody matters. And unfortunately, in our culture, particularly over the last 30 years, we've become a culture that's got kind of a first class and a second class and a third class.
And lastly, just a list, a string of things that you can practically point to and maybe qualify them with a brief explanation as to how they match up with the general worldview of progressives, leftists, and radicals.
Mm-hmm. And things that actually are commons?
Mm-hmm.
Well, the internet is a commons. The airwaves are a commons. And the airwaves, unfortunately, have become privatized. People that own a television station making tons and tons of money off of what are airwaves that belong to everybody, they don't have to do anything in return for it. The internet is also, it's I think one of the reasons it's flourished is because it is a commons. But unfortunately now, the net neutrality rules that provide everyone access to the internet are under fire. You know, the commons are just things that we all can use, and that itself, I think, is a very progressive idea. You know, national parks are one of the first things people think about a commons, but actually the street in front of our house is a commons, and scientific knowledge is a commons. And one of the things that I think can light a fire under people is that, you know, we pay so much for pharmaceutical drugs in our country, and a large amount of those drugs actually were developed with our own tax money, and then someone has gotten extraordinarily rich off of it. So there's a sense of fair play. I mean, you know, this is a great idea, I think, to revitalize the left, but I think also there's a lot of folks that wouldn't think of themselves as leftists at all, but the idea of the commons just plain makes sense to them. And I think, you know, some of these people, you know, might today call themselves conservative, but when exposed to a concept like the commons, it may suddenly lead to kind of a change of heart.
Well, of course, if you look at the percent of the population that would consider themselves to be openly on the left would be so small, you would have to have a lot of projects for a revitalized left that was attracting people who don't define themselves
exactly
that way presently. And what about something like Wikipedia?
Wikipedia is a great example of commons. I mean, it's something that, you know, people work on together. And, you know, Wikipedia came under a lot of fire at one point as just being unreliable, and just you had these kind of nutcases, you know. And I think there are some pranks that are played on it. But actually, they did a study, and Wikipedia's accuracy rate is not any different from the traditional encyclopedias, because it has the built-in mechanism that if someone comes in and spews some disinformation, someone else is going to come by probably the next day and correct it again. So it's a belief in some ways. The commons is sort of a belief in common decency and in the value of the common. We used to say the common man, now the common person.
Jay Waljasper, I want to thank you so much for joining us here on Building a Powerful Left in the United States.
Yeah, and if people want more information, they can go to our website, onthecommons.org. There's a lot more information about the commons. You can download the first chapter of the book for free, and the book's available for sale there as well. All That We Share, A Field Guide to the Commons.
Thank you so much.
Thank you, Alan.
I'm Alan Minsky, and this is Building a Powerful Left in the United States. We have a surprise for you. Just as they have been a surprise on the left that seemed to have lost its humor and they exploded on the scene of the American left and the international left during the counter-globalization movement, the Yes Men. I'm joined right now by Joseph Huff Hannon, a part-time Yes Man and a board member for the Yes Lab for Creative Activism. So, humor, joy, subversion, how important are they to building a powerful left in the United States?
I think it's a question that answers itself. I think that the more that we can make our activism and our organizing fun and joyous, you know, the less likely that people are going to burn out, the less likely that people are going to think, oh, activism and organizing is for serious, boring people. So I think that, you know, when we can create actions that people have fun with and that make people feel powerful, that just sort of gives people more of an appetite to do more and get more involved and challenge power.
So can you tell a little bit about what the Yes Men are up to and how you see the Yes Men as fitting into the critique of global capitalism, which the Yes Men have been a part of?
Sure. I mean, I think I'm going to talk more about our new project, which is called the Yes Lab for Creative Activism. I mean, I think most people have known the Yes Men as a few, you know, characters that sort of pop up in unlikely places and business conferences and on the news, feigning, kind of imitating, you know, powerful spokespeople for powerful corporations or government bodies. But the new project involves working closely with other activist groups and advocacy organizations to kind of expand their toolbox and use more of these fun, creative, provocative tactics that I think are, you know, more subversive and challenge power and challenge, you know, powerful corporations more. You know, I think an interesting example is something that we weren't directly involved in, but the recent kind of counter-protest to the Koch brothers, big billionaire confab, you know, just the last couple of days in California, where they were basically outed by, you know, a lot of great groups that, you know, kind of pulled the curtain off from the sort of these incredibly powerful corporations and billionaires that are literally getting together to plot the demise of democracy. So I think by using humor and using some sort of, you know, kind of subversive imagery, basically a lot of our work is pulling the curtain back and showing how power works and how it operates. So the Yes Lab is all about training more activists and more NGOs how to do that kind of thing.
And do you find that people are ever more responsive to your work, given the nature of the economic crisis and the role of finance, capital, and the like in the crisis?
I think all of those things make it even more imperative that we have a sense of humor and that we match our anger and our frustration and our understandable outrage at the way that, you know, the sort of business class and the kind of ruling class has plundered the economy, that we have a sense of humor about it, and that our reactions are sometimes, you know, using humor, using subversion to, you know, kind of help us laugh at some very unfunny things, you know. And then I think it just kind of helps, you know, it gives us a little more of a wind at our backs as we're, you know, kind of David against Goliath kind of activism. But I think it's, I think it's also unexpected. I think power is used to, you know, people writing very, you know, kind of like sanctimonious or serious critiques, or, you know, people out on the street. But I think, you know, kind of more subversive, humorous, sarcastic kinds of activism can be a little more jarring and a little more unnerving for powerful institutions.
One final question. When you're out there and about and you're with the Yes Men, is your sense right now that people are really craving alternatives to the current system?
I mean, you know, I think every day people are trying to figure out how to, I mean, that's kind of a big question. I think campaign by campaign, people are figuring out what works and what doesn't. You know, we have used some techniques that we think work good at some ways, that are not so good at other things, but that, sort of bit by bit, you know, kind of player by player, corporation by corporation, trying to build a world where there's more people power and less corporate power. And I think humor can be a good way to take some of our power back.
Joseph Huff Hannon, part-time Yes Man and full-time board member for the Yes Lab for Creative Activism. Thank you for joining us.
Anytime. Take care now. Have a good day.
I'm your MC, Alan Minsky, and that's our show for today. Want to thank our guests Jimmy Dore, Mark Ames, Sansara Taylor, Brian Becker, Vijay Prashad, Jay Wall Jasper, and Joseph Huff Hannon from the Yes Men. Special thanks to assistant producers Vanessa Gonzalez, Evan Kendall, and Melisa Figueroa, webmaster for buildingapowerfulleft.org. And special thanks to engineer Tamika Miller. You can hear this and all previous shows from the series at kpfk.org and buildingapowerfulleft.org. And before I go, I have a special announcement to make. Stemming from the first installment of this series and our conversation with Stephen Duncombe about virtual spaces where a left can exchange ideas and build consensus and community, the production team of this series has secured the domain name wikileft.org. And we're hoping to build it up into a site where across the country and across the world, activist events can be documented and announced. And yes, there can be an exchange of ideas that can lead to the building of a powerful left, not only here in the United States, but across the world. And just like with Wikipedia, everyone's invited. So we'll be getting wikileft.org up and running in the coming days and weeks. That's it for today. Tune in again tomorrow at 4 p.m. Pacific Standard Time for another installment of Building a Powerful Left in the United States. In the suburbs,